Hi, here we are.
Here we are.
We are here. You can hear me in the back? Yes. You can hear me. Need more volume back there? Okay. Speaking of lectures, there's one tomorrow night in Memorial Lounge at 7. This one is also free. This one is an annual lecture in memory of Armin Grams, who was the founding faculty member in Human Development and Family Studies at UVM. And it is being given tomorrow evening by Charlie Pierce, whose name may be familiar if you read the Boston Globe. He's a sports writer and columnist. He also appears on NPR, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and one of the other news programs. And I'm told he's a very engaging speaker. He's not going to be talking about sports tomorrow night. He's going to be talking about a book that he wrote called Hard to Forget. And it is a personal story that he wrote of his family coping with his father and two uncles all having Alzheimer's at the same time. So that generation in his family, I've assumed, I don't know, but I've assumed that the two uncles were his father's brothers. Anyway, what he did as a writer was cope with this by researching Alzheimer's and what we know about it, and also how it affects families, so that they could figure out how to deal with it. And then he describes in the book, and will tomorrow night, how Alzheimer's begins to affect the family and the extended family and changes the relationships and how people cope with having somebody in the family who is beginning to lose memory. And when there are three of those happening, then you have an extended family all dealing with it at the same time. And I assume he will also be talking about the implications for himself of having the parental generation have what is most likely a heritable form of Alzheimer's. So think about if you're a writer, knowing that there is a hereditary condition which might cause you to lose memory early. I'm told he's very engaging. It'll be fun. Not entirely depressing, but very informative. So anybody interested in aging, interested in your own grandparents or parents, or family systems and how they cope with chronic and terminal diseases would find that interesting. So I encourage that. And as if that weren't enough, if you don't want to do that one, at the same time, Mark Estrin, who wrote Insect Dreams, which is a book and a movie that many of you are familiar with. Estrin will be at Living Learning at 7 in Fireplace Lounge to read from his book and discuss it, and have a book signing. And I'm told he's also very interesting. He will be looking at that depressing topic. I'm glad I'm going to the one on Alzheimer's. Anyway, so one or the other. Don't stay home tomorrow night and claim to be bored. And if you're looking for some way, reasonable way to some excuse for getting out of doing work in the evening, either of those will serve as a fine excuse for not doing work between 7 and 9 in the evening. Let's see, one more announcement, and that is the review sessions. We are scheduled. We are confirmed. So both review sessions and the exam will be here. That makes it easy. You don't have to learn your way to any new room, and I don't have to learn any new technology. So after class on Wednesday next week, a week from today, we'll start right after class. I put 4:50 there because there is a class in here at 5, and we'll have to bail. We can continue in the hallway if anybody wants to. And the next day at 4, also here. And then the final exam the next day at 11:45 a.m., not p.m. Okay. That's on the website. That will be on the website this evening. And I'll probably annoy you by sending spam to everybody in the class to remind you sometime next week. Okay? Any other questions? The old exercise is still hanging around up here. The one we did on Monday, we'll get back next week. And exercise 5, assignment 5, will be back on Monday. So you can look forward to that. Anything else? Okay. We're good. Anything from you? On Monday, we will have an up-to-date distribution, including assignment 5. And I will go through the mock exercise of saying, on Monday. That's a commitment. Hold me to it. Okay. Yes. But you're all passing. Does that help? Yeah. Well, one of you isn't, but you know who you are. I don't, but you do. That's a joke. I'm sorry. Wrong? I'm sorry. It is the wrong time of the semester to joke about grades. Forget I did it. I'm sorry. Mea culpa. We do not joke about grades at this time in the semester. And while we're at it, talking about being nice to each other, do not break up. Do not discuss your relationship and your problems with it. Okay. Just suspend all relationship work. Do not fight with your significant others or roommates from now until after you finish exams. It's not permitted. Okay. No arguments, no fights, no breaking up. Okay. Period. And if your significant other starts to pick a fight with you, say, Larry said, we can't discuss that until after we're done with exams. Yeah. All relationship work is suspended until after exams. Then you can have at it, but then it won't affect your semester. All right, let's talk about one of those topics that we all love to talk about. And this, I'm going to talk from the Renkel article that you have, which is a quick and dirty summary of some of the findings of the relationship of birth order, where you are in the sibling constellation in the family. The relation of that to personality and how we grow up. This has been a topic that has exercised philosophers and psychologists and family studies people for many, many years, like 2,000 years at least, in the literature. And it's a fun topic because it is something that most of us have an opinion on. Even in my senior seminar on family systems, the first couple of papers this semester, people were writing gross generalizations about well, of course I do this because I'm a middle child, or I'm the youngest, or I'm the oldest, and it's always fun to ask them what the reference is for that. But there is literature that is fairly consistent, and Renkel has done a reasonable job of looking at that. And this was a popular article that came out of Parenting, so it's not too challenging in understanding the methodology. The research is fairly clear that within very broad limits, people who occupy the same birth position in a family share some similarities in personality. And then there's also variability among us, so that it's not reasonable to say that all firstborns are X or all lastborns are X. There are many factors that influence that, including temperament, gender, parental preferences, parenting styles, all of those usual variables within the family system that influence how we're going to experience it. What I want to do today, for the first part of the session, is to just review quickly what she says about the connections, and then see if we can understand why there might be a connection between where you are in the sibling order and what kind of personality you have. This is a developmental question. What would being the youngest, the oldest, a middle, an only, or a twin, what would that do to your experience in the microsystem that would encourage you to construct a view of yourself and of the world and a set of skills and motivation that would be similar to other people who occupy that same position? Okay? Clear question? Reasonable. So we're not going to argue whether the descriptions that she uses apply to everybody. We're going to accept that they don't. And if you're the exception or you know the exception, that's fine. One of the questions to ask yourself is, if I am an exception, can I explain that developmentally? Can I apply Bronfenbrenner to understand why my situation might have been different? So, what are you? How many of you are onlys, only children? I think I asked that the first day. There are literally only two and one GTF. Blows my mind. So we know that there are more only children at UVM. We believe that. We believe there are more in this class. So the question developmentally is, why do not only children come to class? Why do only children not come to class? This is an interesting question. I'll leave that for you to think. But anyway, two of you are here. How many of you are the oldest of a whole bunch? Or three? Oldest. How many of you are youngest of three or more? Oh, that's interesting. Okay. How many of you are second? Third? Okay, so maybe it's oldest, youngest. And we've already determined that there is only one twin in here, I think. That's it, one twin, right? And both of you are not here. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand. Two of you are twins, but not with each other. Okay, two of you are twins, but not with each other. Okay, so you're going to get to explain in a few minutes what is different about being a twin. All right. What does Renkel say? Firstborns, natural leaders. And she explains that by suggesting that firstborns have full parental attention. There you are. You're the first to every milestone, so you get celebrated. And in personality, you tend to be focused and somewhat detail-oriented and possibly perfectionistic. And usually people explain that by suggesting that because of all that parental attention, the expectations are high and you're trying to live up to the parents as models because there aren't any other kids at the point when you're going through the various milestones and learning everything. So that's usually what comes up in that. So you're the ones, the firstborns are the ones with completed baby books and lots of pictures. So parents are paying a lot of attention and they're learning on you. We call you the experimental group for parents. They're learning how to parent with you, and the mistakes they make are making you tougher and strengthening you. Okay? The research is fairly consistent. Other kinds of research that firstborns tend to be more focused on adults. They tend to be more comfortable with adults, and only children continue that to a greater degree. The firstborns and onlys tend to have higher achievement goals for themselves and to achieve more. So they're higher achieving than the rest of us. More driven, some of us call it. The secondborns, when you come along after, you've got somebody leading the way for you, and the parents are busier. And Renkel suggests that secondborns tend to be innovators. They do things differently. She suggests that the parents are calmer and more relaxed. Another way to think about that is the parents are busier and more distracted. They're more relaxed about the child, the middle child, the secondborn, because they've got the first one they're paying attention to and they're busier, so they tend to be a little less fussy about what the secondborn is doing, and that helps the secondborn perhaps figure out his or her own ways to do things as a child. Parents are still focused on the older. What the secondborn is doing is less interesting unless you do it differently. So if you're secondborn, one of the ways you get attention is to do things differently than your older sibling did. And they tend to be competent because they have an older model, somebody showing them how to do things or how not to do things. So secondborns are often less trouble, in part because they're figuring out how to do things on their own. And if the older one, the firstborn, has been a troublemaker, then the secondborn has figured out how not to be a troublemaker. So I can quote my mother, who said, "I never had any problem with you at all. We never had any problem with you at all." My older brother was also very easy, and she didn't have much trouble with him. But I watched him make waves as a leader type. And I watched him make waves, and I watched him kind of shake things up a little bit, and I figured out how to be parents' pet. I can be parents' pet. I can figure out how to do what I want to do without appearing on the radar screen. Okay. So secondborn gets to study the older and figure out how not to do it. Emily? Right. And so you get to think about, the observation is that things change when you become the only child. And that's a transition that changes the microsystem. So when the older goes off to college, there you are, and the microsystem changes and your role in it changes, and parents stop worrying about the one who went off to college and focus all of that wonderful attention on you, which can be a drag, because you've been under the radar, potentially, and particularly if there's anybody younger than you, and now you suddenly change position. So that's a beginning hint about how you apply developology to understand the changes that take place in the microsystem as people come in and out of it. So tuck that in the back of your, or the middle of your head, because as each person comes in and out of the microsystem, the pattern is going to change, parental focus is going to change, and for some of us, it's a significant change in the dyadic relationships that we have with parents. And that may make it more difficult, it may make it easier, depending on what's happening to us and how the microsystem is shifting. So there's a whole pattern that is being set up here that we have to look at. There's a wonderful book by somebody whose name I can't remember called Born to Rebel, which I've lost the name. It starts with an S-H maybe. No, it's in my notes somewhere. And the book is devoted to looking at secondborns in history and the research on them, and concludes that a large percentage of revolutionary figures, now the sort of the super innovators, people who really change the world and their place in it or the settings that they're in, tend to be second born. And in the book, the author proposes that the second born has come along, watched the system with the first born, and has often the difficulty of being noticed, and becomes an innovator, as Rankel is suggesting, but then takes that to the extreme of saying, I refuse to be second best. I want you to notice me, and I'm going to kick over the whole system in order to make that happen. And the book just lists and describes the family situations of dozens of revolutionary figures, people who changed the world, both for good and for bad, who happened to be second borns, and it's a very interesting analysis. If you want that, I will remember who it is, but the title is Born to Rebel. Okay, what if there's a third and you're the second? What if you're the middle? Now you take that being second born, so you're a bit of an innovator and you've learned to do things differently, you may be a little show-offy, but then along comes a younger one. How does that change what happens to us as second borns? If you look at the second of three, the middle of three, or the second and third of four, people who are in the middle, the important feature of them is that they have both older and younger siblings. So anything in the middle will tend to be more similar to each other than to the oldest or the youngest. So the middle, Rankel suggests, become negotiators. They become mediators. They have someone to learn from and someone to nurture. So you've got multiple roles. So you learn to deal with people who have more power than you and people who have less power than you. You get to be more flexible because you have the opportunity to have a dyadic relationship with two different kinds of people. People who are siblings. People who are older and more powerful, people who are younger and less powerful. And that leads to better ability to relate to diversity, better ability to deal with a group, better listening skills, better skills at joining in activities, because there have been different kinds of activities. So this is the position that has the most complex set of opportunities, activities, and ways of relating within the family system because of having both younger and older siblings. You can be taken seriously by parents because you get to be the nurturer of the younger one, and they're not going to overprotect you because there's somebody younger than you to overprotect. And what happens with that in the positive sense, if you have those multiple roles, remember Bronfenbrenner talking about the opportunity to interact with people who occupy a variety of roles. Well, older sibling and younger sibling is twice as many as other people have if they can only relate to somebody who's older or somebody who's younger. The middle gets to interact with twice as many roles within the family and to occupy twice as many roles. So if sibling order is going to be effective, it's in part because you get more experience in creating dyadic relationships that are more varied if you're in the middle position. And some of the literature suggests that we, middle children, tend to do better as social workers, negotiators, therapists, and other people who have the skill, or where other positions, other kinds of occupations, where the ability to take different people's perspectives and understand them is useful. The social skills, the interpersonal skills, may be better, and we've learned to negotiate the power differences between ourselves and people who are more powerful and people who are less powerful. So we have a better understanding, supposedly, of how to negotiate in situations where people have unequal power. In the less favorable light, some of us become show-offs because we're kind of lost in the middle. And some of us learn to keep a really low profile and stay under the radar for a long time. And that can be detrimental if you're unwilling to be noticed, if you're unwilling to take chances to put yourself out in social situations or in work situations. Then we have the babies. So what happens to them? There they are. Everybody is more powerful than they are. Everybody is more skilled than they are. And they have lots of exposure to older kids and activities, so they are more likely to get into trouble of all kinds. They're less likely to have learned to nurture other people and to expect to be nurtured themselves, because everybody is bigger than they are and they're the ones who are least competent, and so everybody spoils them and is indulgent with them, and so you learn to expect that. And that lets you be fun-loving and affectionate and outgoing as long as people are spoiling you. And they may have difficulty respecting authority because they've been permitted to do anything they want to do. And they may become dependent on other people. That doesn't apply to anybody here. And then you have the onlys. And they are firstborns without the opportunity to have anybody younger, so they never have to share the limelight. They get to be adults early on and relate well to adults. But they've not had anybody close to their own age in the household. So they may have missed some of the peer skills early on, learning to relate to people who are less powerful than they are, or more powerful as the middles and youngers get. So they're missing that important ingredient, that important role of relating to other children, until they get off into childcare and school and the peer group. Then they may learn some of those. Sarah? The question is, does the spacing have any impact? And Renkel describes other variables that have an impact as gender, for one, because the family may treat boys and girls very differently. A youngest who is male may be treated quite differently than a youngest who is female. And that varies so much among families that it's very difficult to sort that out and generalize about the effect of gender, just to say that it may have an impact in a particular family. Spacing is very important. And your example was somebody who has a sibling who's 18 when she was born. That's sort of like having three parents at that point. The effects of the sibling order are clearest when the siblings are close enough together so that they're actually considered siblings, and they, as we describe it sometimes, they run in a pack. Or they're close enough in age that they can gang up on the parents. And the parents can at times treat the kids as a group and refer to them as the kids in the same way that children are likely to relate to the rents or the parental unit as a single entity rather than individual mom and dad. Yeah. So if that is the case and the siblings are close enough together so that they actually deal with each other as siblings with different degrees of power and skill, then you see the kind of general results that Renkel describes. When you get outside that ability to relate to each other as siblings, when the spacing is so great that you're more than a developmental stage apart, then the analysis and the results tend to be quite different. The analysis breaks down because the kids aren't really treating each other as siblings. Adolescents who are dealing with newborns tend not to treat them as younger siblings, but as babies, and take responsibility for them as babies. They take not a sibling role where they're going to fight with the kid. If you're close enough to fight, to have disagreements, you learn the negotiation skills. An 18-year-old doesn't fight with an infant. There's nothing to negotiate. You may be envious, you may be jealous, you may take over the parental role, but it's not really a sibling relationship in the common sense of that term when that spacing is so great. It's interesting to speculate on what spacing is important. And there's a little bit of speculation on this, but not much real literature. What happens is that if you're more than two developmental stages apart, then all of the generalizations fall apart. If you're just one stage separate, which most of us are when we're born, the exception is twins or triplets, but if we're one stage apart, then we're often negotiating between those stages. So you have the person who is older than you is typically no more than one stage ahead of you, unless the spacing is great. So if you're a pre-operational kid dealing with a formal operational person, they're two stages apart, cognitively, and there's no negotiating there, because the power is so different and the view of the world is so different. So what happens with twins? That's one of the other variables. Twins and triplets. Siblings of the same age. That's what twins and triplets are. It's having a sibling of the same age. And those are unique relationships. Twins have relationships with each other that are different from any other sibling combination. They have reciprocity, they have equal power, they can, and typically do, but not always, create a transcontextual dyad that becomes a very important part of your view of the world. And sometimes, to non-twins, the kind of transcontextual dyadic relationship that twins develop seems almost pathological. You know, how can they be that close? Why would they connect to each other so much? And some twins don't, particularly if they're other gendered fraternal twins, but some do. They create a transcontextual dyad that's very close, depending on the availability of other siblings and other peers. And sometimes, even if parents are determined not to treat the twins as a unit, the twins do it themselves. And the parents can try to differentiate them, not dress them the same, give them names that don't even alliterate. How can you do that to twins? The twins will, some of them, will make up their own nicknames that alliterate. They will refer to themselves as the twins. They will grow up choosing to dress together, similarly. And they will create that similarity and the dependence on each other that is unique. A couple of personal stories. I grew up with a set of twins in the neighborhood, and everybody, including their parents, referred to them as the twins. And then they had a younger sister, so there were three girls, and Maria and Marita and Eleanor. And it was just, they were just part of the group, but none of us, Maria and Marita were identical twins, and none of us could ever tell them apart, so we just called them twin. The twins, hey twins, in the plural, or if there was just one, you just referred to her as twin. And that's the way they grew up. I've lost track of them. I don't know whether they married identical twin brothers. But that is not uncommon, that identical twins marry brothers or identical twins. And that's when you begin to think, this is a little creepy. One of my graduate students at the University of Pittsburgh when I was there was an identical twin. And I loved talking with him because he and his twin were the only children of their parents. So the parents had one pregnancy, two identical twins. And they were the kinds of twins who developed their own language as children, and still occasionally communicated with each other using their own language, their own vocabulary. It had its own grammar. It was very interesting, especially since he was helping me teach language development. He would discuss the language and how it was different from English and how they had developed it. They had not grown up in an isolated situation. They had just figured out as they were developing language that they could create their own. It's one of the wonderful things about language. It's generative, and all the stuff is built in, and all you have to do is create the vocabulary, the references and the words to go with it, and make up some grammar. But the grammar is built into the brain too. So they had that, and they had maintained it. But the fascinating thing was that as part of developing a sense of identity in adolescence, they had decided to differentiate themselves. And this was a mutual decision. I like the fact that they mutually decided they needed to become more different. So they did that. They started dressing. I think it was junior year in high school. They decided dressing differently. One of them would go this direction, the other one would go that direction. They tried different sports. They were both quite athletic, but they focused in different areas. And that was very important for them to discover that they could operate on their own. They even developed different girlfriends. And I don't think they ever actually dated the same person. But as a result of that discovery, they decided it would be good for them to go off to different colleges. And they did that. And by the end of the first semester, they were both so depressed and so unhappy that they both transferred to a third college together. And spent the rest of college rooming together, and then did go different directions for graduate school, and one of them was my graduate fellow for a couple of years there. But he was still in regular contact with his sibling, and they vacationed together. Neither of them was in a significant relationship at that point, so I don't know how they did that part. The other story I have is the identical twin girls who married twin brothers. They were fraternal twin brothers, but and a double wedding. And I can't fathom it because I'm not a twin. Okay, that's a unique position. Doesn't fit your experience, does it? No. Yeah, either of you. And it's all because your mother dressed her in blue instead of pink. She's been confused ever since. Verity, what was your experience? I mean, I'm sorry. Where did I get that? Where'd that come from? Aramie, yeah. I mispronounced you. So in high school, you did some differentiation. Abby. Abby's question is, do twins tend to compensate for each other's weaknesses, or do they develop different strengths intellectually? And that's one of those variables. Some twins have very different intellects, particularly fraternal twins. And fraternal twins are no more similar than anybody else, any other siblings. They have the same parents, but different genetics. The only thing they have in common is that they have experienced roughly the same environment growing up. They've had each other. But to the extent that they're different, they've had different environments. And identical twins are, because they have the same genetics, are more likely to have similar intellect, but that's not guaranteed either. So it's highly variable what happens to them cognitively as they grow up.
Because she had issues like that, and I think, well, did he like
It's particularly when there are gender differences attached to that. Part of the relationship negotiation that twins have to do is how much to be different and how to be different and how much to help each other. So compensation is a potential, if there are differences, that they help each other. And the intellectual differences may be the basis for differentiating themselves and having quite different interests, particularly fraternal twins. When you get to the identicals, they're more likely to have those similar interests. And every textbook on development has the picture of the identical twins who were separated in infancy. You've seen that one, the two firemen. And they grew up in completely separate households. They didn't know each other. They had no connection with each other. They both ended up being firemen. And there's a classic picture of them in their outfits next to a fire engine. There have been other situations. I watched one program on twins several years ago where twins who had never met were reintroduced to each other in their 40s, and they each dressed for the filming without knowing what was going to happen, nothing about what was going to happen. It was going to be a surprise for both of them, and the producers swear that they did nothing to orient them in any particular direction, and they both showed up wearing basically identical outfits. That's spooky. My other personal story from here is an identical twin at Bi-Zi I had once who was on the bus. She had a sudden, the twins lived in different parts of the state, and she was overwhelmed one day by the need to go home and see her identical twin. She was a sophomore here, and so she was taking the bus south, and as she reported it, she experienced a very severe and sharp pain in her hand on the bus and didn't understand it. It gradually went away, had a little bit of an ache. Got home, her sister was not at home. Her sister was in the emergency room getting sewn up because she had fallen with a knife in her hand and had nearly severed her thumb. At about the same time that... I'm not going there. I believe in extrasensory perception and all those things, but I'm not going there. Okay, so how do we explain this? Sibling order and the spacing and the gender, the whole constellation of how many kids there are, how many adults there are, create the microsystem and the potential relationships within it. The sibling order creates the dyads that everybody is experiencing. And each person is experiencing a different microsystem. Remember that from Bronfenbrenner. Okay. That the microsystem is the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities experienced by the developing person, and each sibling has a different microsystem. Same household, but it's a different microsystem. Each sibling has a different position in that microsystem, has the potential for experiencing different dyads, as Renkel says, depending on whether you have older siblings, younger siblings, neither, both. The whole pattern of power relationships, power differentials, and activities that you can engage in depends on that constellation. And it also defines the family mesosystem. How many settings are there? Are you following your older siblings to activities that they engage in so you get introduced to them with your parents there, with the older siblings there? Or are you the firstborn deciding which settings everybody is going to get introduced to later? Are you the only? So the family mesosystem revolves around you and the activities that you engage in. Are you the youngest choosing to do different things because you get tired of following everybody around? Are you the middle who gets to go to all kinds of places? You get to go with the big kids, you get to go with little kids, you get to hang on to the activities that you enjoy even though you're too old for them because you're helping take care of your younger siblings. The whole set of activities is in part shaped by your order in the constellation. Parents create them, but each individual gets to construct his or her own view of the world and the skills that lead to it. So the sibling order differences begin to make sense when you realize that each person is experiencing a different microsystem. So if the family roles and relationships and activities are creating the experiences from which you're going to construct your view of the world, it makes sense that each person in a different sibling order is going to see the world differently and have different skills for dealing with it. Make sense? If I were doing a writing exercise today, which I'm not, this is the question I would ask. Or if I had gotten to this material on Monday, this is the one you would have been asked. I mean, think about that question. Great final exam essay question. Okay, let's spend a few minutes looking at some other issues. Okay, so the question is, does your sibling position have any influence on the kind of dating or significant romantic relationships that you might get into? Yeah, it does. Should you not date somebody in the same sibling position? Why would somebody suggest that you not do that? Because you're too much alike, perhaps. That generalization is probably true if you're talking about being onlys, or if you're talking about being oldest, or if you're talking about being youngest. So if both of you are the youngest, you're both going to expect the other person to spoil you. If both of you are oldest, you're both going to want to be in charge. Conflict. Both of you are onlys, you don't know how to behave toward each other because you're going to be looking toward the adults. But if you're both middles, you're so flexible and lovable that you can get along with anybody. So we middles make kind of like universal blood donors if we get together, but only if we get together. Now, let me suggest that there is a literature on that. It's a really funny literature. And the best description of it was done by a man named Tolman in a book on sibling order, sibling position. And Tolman's work was based on clinical observation, and it's not particularly scientific, but it is occasionally quoted. Tolman says that it's very useful, and you can do this with your own parents. It's very, very interesting to look at where they are in the sibling position within their families of origin. And what you're looking for, according to Tolman, is not whether they're in the same position, but whether they're in the complementary position. And both position and gender are important. So Tolman argues that what we experience growing up, and whether we have older siblings, younger siblings, both, whether we're a brother of sisters or a brother of brothers, all of those things, you can think about all the possible combinations of gender and position. Wherever you are, creates a set of familiar, I'm going to call them patterns or schemes, the way of feeling comfortable in the world. I'm comfortable with older brother and younger sisters because that's the constellation that I have. Okay? So you can do that for each of your parents. And then Tolman says that what you're going to see in a couple relationship is that people who are reproducing the familiar relationship for both of them are the ones who are going to have the easiest time creating a relationship because it's familiar. It may not be equal power, it may not be reciprocal, and it may have other issues in it, but it will be easiest to feel comfortable in. If, for example, a guy like me, I'm a brother with an older brother and younger sisters. So I know how to relate to both of those. If I'm going to get married, if I'm going to get partnered up, I want somebody who has been a younger sister of brothers. You see how that works? That's the complementary role. When we get together and I get involved with somebody who has older brothers, then we're both going to be comfortable. We know how to behave. And the older brother is going to take care of the younger sisters, right? The younger sister is going to be expect to be taken care of by the older brother. So it may not be the perfect relationship from an equal power point of view, but it's going to be comfortable, and therefore, whatever the conflicts are, we know how to resolve. The fascinating thing, and you can do it for any of the positions, you can also figure out which ones are going to be most likely to have conflict, because nobody's familiar in it. If neither party has been in that same situation before, then you have conflict. The thing that fascinates me is this totally just common sense, intuitive system that Tolman has. I knew there was something wrong. It's Tolman, T-O-M-A-N. So if you try to look it up with the L in it, you won't find it. I knew there was something wrong. It's a nagging thing. The fascinating thing for me is how often it works. So do it with your parents. Do it with your... See if they are in a compatible situation, or if they're in a situation where one or both of them is not likely to be familiar. So, who did I marry the first time? A woman who was an older sister of a brother. Not supposed to work. We're divorced. Who did I marry the second time? That one. Will that work? 330 weeks today, and we haven't had a significant disagreement yet. So, it's really scary. It's really scary. So, look at your significant other. Figure out your sibling order. Figure out his sibling position. And are you in a situation to be comfortable? And then keep track. Do it for your parents. We could do a research study in here. You could do it for your parents. About half of you have divorced parents. So we could figure out if it's likely that you could have predicted that on the basis of sibling position. Thank you for that question. I wasn't going to talk about Tolman's work. But it suggests that the things you will hear from your great aunt Sally about not marrying somebody in the same position are not quite true, but they lead to an analysis that might have some developmental validity. Again, you're talking about somebody who has been in a particular kind of dyad or a group of dyads with different power, different gender experiences, and then when you partner up with somebody, the critical question is, are your views of the world compatible? If what you expect from a peer that you are now going to be involved with are compatible, that may get you past the first set of potential conflicts. If they're not, according to Tolman, you may never get past that first set of conflicts because you're never comfortable in the situation. I really am torn about this. I really want somebody to validate this with a good, solid research study. But I'm really afraid that they'll discover it doesn't work. So I don't want them to do it. But somebody needs to do it. If you want a good doctoral dissertation and you're in psychology, sociology, human development, there it is. I'll help you design the hypotheses and the methodology, and we'll do it. Lila. When you adopt? Yeah. On Monday, I'd like to tackle a couple of issues. So I'm going to ask you, what are some of the situations that you've seen families face? Older child adoption. And does it make a difference if you adopt somebody who's older than the kids that you already have? Foster care, anything else you want to talk about, we'll tackle some of those developmentally. The question is, what do they do to the microsystem and therefore to the ability of the family to facilitate development? We're also going to be looking at divorce. So here's one you can put in your thinking cap. What does it do to the microsystem, or to the ecosystem? What does it do to the ecosystem when one of the parents has an affair? How would you describe the ecosystem when one person has an affair, but it's not discovered? And then what happens to the ecosystem when it is discovered? And we'll look at that, and then we're going to look at divorce and other situations. This is the infamous student survey of teaching. So take one of each. If you have a number two pencil, use it. If you don't, I have the obnoxious little golf pencils. You didn't have to catch that one. Just take them and pass them along over there. Anybody else need number twos? Just pass them back. And you get to keep these. The pencils. Who needs what?
We got some extra Scantrons.
You've got extra Scantrons. Who needs a Scantron? You need Scantrons. There you go. One for you.
Give
me another. And they have the surveys over here. All right. Who needs the surveys? There you go. Okay. So, equal distribution of resources. Everybody has a survey, a Scantron, and a number two. You have extras too. All right. Yeah, there should be extras. Everybody has everything. Don't put your names on them. In the subject line, you can put HDFS 60 if you would like. So patiently waiting. And when you finish, if you will bring them down and put them in this envelope, the Scantrons and the survey sheet, if you make any comments on it, and we will read after the grades are in, we will read all of the comments after they've been typed. We don't get to see the original sheets. And when you're done with that, you're free to go.